process of seafloor spreading and subduction and mountain creation and volcanoes. Because out there, 200 kilometers off Vancouver Island, you can see the Wanda-Fuca Ridge on the seafloor, and that is where the seafloor is spreading apart, and we have underwater volcanoes, we have this rifting process, we have hot vents coming up as this magma comes up onto the seafloor and cools and becomes part of the plates. It's like sometimes you see on television those wonderful time-lapse pictures of flowers growing, and you suddenly see the flower put out its petals and then bend as the sun goes round during the day, or grow up the wall and over a few months. If you were to consider time-lapse photography of the Earth, or of Vancouver Island, for instance, and then you start speeding it up but putting millions of years instead of seconds behind it, or minutes, you would see we were in the middle of an almighty great collision, and you would see that the ocean floor is moving past Vancouver Island very, very fast. You would see that the island itself is rising and tilting, and that bits of the Queen Charlotte Island are probably trundling on their way to Alaska and will eventually end up in Yakutat Bay or something like that. And it would appear to be a constantly moving, dynamic process. And the closest thing you can imagine is looking at a river in the spring breakup, when you see all these plates of ice moving and jostling amongst themselves. And that's exactly what the Earth's surface is doing now.
You're listening to Earth in Motion, one of the first in the Earth Chronicles Voice Scape series, produced by yours truly between 1992 and 1993, over 30 years ago. Here's the second half of Earth in Motion.
My name is Chris Yorath. I'm a geologist with the Geological Survey of Canada, and I work at the Pacific Geoscience Center, which is located near Sydney, just north of Victoria on Vancouver Island. Each and every citizen of Victoria and along the coast of Vancouver Island knows that the Earth is in motion. It is a fact of life. People who go to cocktail parties here and playgrounds and live in their own homes from time to time experience an earthquake. Most of them so far, fortunately, are relatively low magnitude events, commonly one or two a week of the magnitude, say around 3 on the Richter scale. However, from time to time, every 50 or 60 years, we get a bigger one. And this demonstrates to everybody here that the Earth is in motion, that it's not static, and this is the reason for the Earth being in motion in this part of the world. Is because plates are in motion. As you know, the Earth's plates, or the Earth's surface, is like a soccer ball. It's divided up into 16 or more large so-called tectonic plates that are constantly moving, each one moving independently. And we have this situation off the coast of Vancouver Island and the Queen Charlotte Islands, where in this region we see the interaction, or feel the interaction, of three major plates. The largest one being the North American plate, which is separated from the huge Pacific Oceanic plate by what we call the Wanda-Fuca Ridge. And it is along the Wanda-Fuca Ridge that the sea floors of the Pacific Ocean, or the Pacific plate, and the Wanda-Fuca plate are being created by injections of molten magma from below the crust into this crack called the Wanda-Fuca Ridge. And with each injection, the two plates grow and move away from the ridge. And in the case of the Wanda-Fuca plate, it converges or moves towards the North American plate. And as the North American plate is moving away from another ridge in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the North American plate is moving westwards and the Wanda-Fuca plate is moving eastwards. And where the two come together, one has to give way. And what happens is the Wanda-Fuca plate is consumed, or what we call subducted, beneath the North American plate. And this kind of motion is the kind of thing that generates earthquakes. As the Wanda-Fuca plate converges and descends beneath Vancouver Island and the northern coasts of Washington and Oregon and northernmost California, that as the plate descends, it will reach a depth of approximately 150 to 200 kilometers below the surface, where it'll melt. And as the oceanic plate melts, the molten material then rises upwards back towards the surface through the crust to reappear as a chain of volcanoes that extend from Northern California into Southern British Columbia.
One plate will slice off pieces of the other, rather like a bacon slice. You can imagine pushing a piece of bacon into those machines you used to get in grocery stores where you push the ham across and the wheel goes around and slices pieces of the bacon off. And it looks like that's what's happened along the west coast of Canada, that the fact that the west coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands is this great, massive, straight line, and if you go out into a ship, you're faced with these incredible cliffs, you know, almost thousands of meters high, just a beautiful fault plain right up the west coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands. And you look at it and you say, well, where's the other half? I can see these islands, but where was the piece that was out here? It's been sliced off, and it's probably somewhere up in Alaska now, plastered onto the Alaskan mountains.
The St. Elias Mountains are in the southwestern Yukon, northwesternmost BC, southwestern Yukon, and southeast Alaska. And the highest mountain in North America, Mount McKinley, is in southeast Alaska, and the highest mountain in Canada, Mount Logan, after the first director of the Geological Survey, is in southwestern Yukon, in Kluane National Park, it's called, in the St. Elias. And those mountains, we think, are still rising. The reason why they are rising is exactly the same as the Himalayas are rising. The Himalayas are rising because India is a subcontinent. It crashed into the underside of Asia about 40 million years ago. And it rammed in underneath the underside of Asia and is jacking up the edge of the continent to form the Himalayas. And the St. Elias Mountains, same reason. In the armpit of Alaska, is a piece of crust that is being rammed in underneath Alaska by the northward motion of the Pacific Plate. This block of crust is called the Yakutat Terrane, and it's being carried northward by the Pacific Plate, and it's being rammed in underneath the armpit of Alaska and jacking up the St. Elias Mountains. And we think there's a good chance that that uplift rate is pretty fast, that it's possibly as fast as, say, four millimeters per year, which is really moving.
Some people are just go into a kind of a trance when they're around rocks. Other people pick rocks up in their hand and they kind of look off into space and say that this has got the power and that. I mean, I can hold a rock forever and it doesn't feel any different to me. But I guess that's how they feel about it.
My name is Anne Lansley, and I'm from Brandon, Manitoba. And I went on an expedition with my daughter and her class, and I was invited to be a volunteer with the class by the teacher, and we went off to the Cirrus Rock Shop. Now, the Cirrus Rock Shop is quite an active little place. You go in there, and they hold these school tours. And what they do is you go into the rock shop, and they give you a little tour behind the rock shop of all their rocks. And they've got big bins of all the different kinds of rocks. And they show the kids and everybody who comes through, they show them what the different kind of rocks look like. And you look in a black light and you look at different rocks that are in the black light of things that happen to them. And the rock shop shows what the insides of the rocks look like and fossils and all those kinds of things and what you can make out of rocks. But anyways, when you go out to the rock quarry, there's piles of these rocks that they've been quarrying, and for 40 cents, I think, they take you out there in a way, and you could sit on top of these rock piles, and what you're generally searching for, at least what rock collectors are generally searching for, are the agate, and that's what Cirrus is famous for, is agate. And then there's another rock called jasper, which is other rock people come and get the jasper. And then you also can find fossils, and you go up there, and the kids, you take along an ice cream pail, and the kids are supposed to fill in the rocks, and they're all looking for agates, or they're looking for petrified wood, and the kids go tearing around looking for petrified wood, and they sort of expend a lot of energy. And the minute I got there, I knew right away I was going to have a wonderful time there, and I got myself on top of a big pile of rocks and started searching for rocks, and And the little kids knew right away. I knew what I was doing, and they'd come and steal my rocks, and I kept them all away and managed to get a little collection.
The most fundamental distinction among rocks are those which allow us to classify them as to their origin. And there are three essentially different origins of rocks. There are igneous rocks, and these are rocks that are formed through the freezing and the solidification of molten magma. And this magma is generated usually deep in the crust or below the crust and comes to the surface or is injected into the crust. Now, we have two types of igneous rocks. We have those kinds of igneous rocks that are injected into the crust and freeze below the surface. In other words, they don't reach the surface at the time they froze. And because they freeze below the surface, it takes a long time for them to cool. It takes maybe 50 million years to cool. During that time, the crystals that form those rocks can have time to grow into large enough sizes that you can see them with the unaided eye. Granite, for example, a granite or a granodiorite or a diorite or a quartz diorite, these are all kindreds of granite. These are rocks that cooled initially below the surface such that their crystals had sufficient time to grow so that you can see them with the unaided eye. However, the same kind, if that magma made it all the way to the surface and froze at the surface, at the surface of the Earth at that time, then it cools very, very quickly. And because it cools very, very quickly, the minerals do not have time to grow to sufficient size so that you can see them with the unaided eye. And that's why you have volcanic rocks at the surface and what we call plutonic rocks, or intrusive rocks below the surface. So those are igneous rocks, for example. Then we have sedimentary rocks. As the name suggests, are just simply particles of sediment that are eroded from either igneous rocks or sedimentary rocks or metamorphic rocks, and they're the products of the detrital products of erosion that accumulate in a sedimentary basin and become buried over a long period of time. And through over the process of burial, they become what we call lithified or converted into rock. So there's a whole bunch of these things. And then you can take those two kinds of rocks, igneous rocks and sedimentary rocks, you can take those two, and you can bury them and subject them to intense pressure and heat and convert them into metamorphic rocks. And these are rocks, metamorphic rocks, are just simply pre-existing rocks of either igneous origin or sedimentary origin that have been completely recrystallized such that the original components, the original minerals of the rocks have completely changed, and the structure of the materials have been completely changed through the application of intense pressure and temperature. The coast mountains, for example, have large masses of very what we call high-grade metamorphic rocks in them, because we think that these rocks were very intensely deformed under terrific temperature and pressure. In other words, in some cases we've got evidence whereby rocks in southeastern British Columbia that form the Almanica Belt, or rocks here in along the coast belt, have been uplifted to be exposed today at the surface, and they were uplifted from depths as great as 25 kilometers.
The Precambrian Shield, I think the terminology was established geographically. I'm Dr. Janet King of the Geological Survey of Canada. It's a large, massive area exposed as a crystalline core, really, of the North American continent. As a shield, geologically, what it is an amalgamation of the very earliest rocks in the world. And they have seen tremendous deformation and metamorphism. They are crystalline rocks. They form this very hard core onto which younger rocks, such as form the mountains in the Canadian Cordillera, or as form the mountains in the Appalachians, have accreted onto and have built outward from this nucleus for the North American continent.
Basically, the Canadian Shield is composed of hundreds of lines of volcanic arcs. It's essentially as if you take Take an area like the southwestern Pacific, regions like the Philippines and Japan and New Guinea, which are island arcs plastered together or plastered against continents. Essentially, the same type of rocks and same type of structures are seen in the oldest rocks of the Canadian Shield, and in fact, most other continents.
Of course, the heart of North America is the Canadian Shield, which extends right down into the United States and under the rocks that you find in most of the United States, and under the rocks in eastern and west coasts. They are the results of earlier plates which opened and collided again and had a very complicated geological history.
These are some of the oldest rocks on planet Earth, the part of the Precambrian Shield, Canadian Shield. Volcanic action, earth eruptions, 1.8 billion years ago, created these rocks. This bluff used to overlook water right here. This was the lake. This is where the ice melted back, the ice age, and this was a lake bottom. Now it's a floor of a farmland in between two valleys. These big rocks down here, there's eagle's nests down here. There's two of them. They raise babies here every year because it's quiet and peaceful. Listen. Yeah, I believe that that everything itself has a vibration or a frequency that it vibrates at, and you can relate to it at that level of spirituality. Some people are more sensitive to rocks. They're rock people. They call them rock tribes. Some are sensitive to trees, water, air, and we all have our own uniqueness as an individual. I've always loved the Canadian Shield. The granite. I've been, since my father first brought me up here when I was 4 years old, I could tell when I reached moving from the limestone to the granite. And I used to say to Dad, "Dad, we're up north now. This would be around Bracebridge, 100 miles south of here." And I still feel that feeling when I get to Bracebridge and I get onto the rock. I can feel the shift change in the energy. And I like the Canadian Shield. I like the granite feelings.
High above, touching the heavenly sky, the eagle honors me. He rests upon my shoulders, knowing my strength. We share past and present. He takes off in flight, assured my brothers and sisters will offer him the same powerful place to land. We are rock alive, and the eagle knows.
Oh, yes, certain rocks are very, very powerful. Yeah, for sure. Some big rocks, some small rocks, things that have certain shapes to them, certain textures or densities. I think that rocks possess energy. Certainly rocks possess energy. Most watches today have crystals that vibrate, and that's, you know, they're provided energy, but they transduce it in very specific ways. And as you know, as such, they modify a lot of the energy and the molecular energies that we work with. So, yeah, I felt power from rocks.
Velvet rock. In the forest, a sea of rock wearing a cloak of moss possessing the touch of velvet. Others before you have passed me by in search of nature's treasures, realizing not that I am the foundation of life.
In the Canadian Shield, we have several subdivisions. The oldest is a Superior province in Ontario, at any rate. And then there's successively younger rocks deposited around this nucleus of old rocks, the Archean rocks of the Superior province. We have slightly younger rocks, the early Proterozoic rocks, which form the southern province. And a lot of the spectacular rocks we see along North Shore, Lake Huron, the Quartz Hills around Killarney, Quartzite Hills around Killarney, the Sudbury area, and the rocks up around Cobalt. There's a lot of silver mines developed. These are all part of the southern province. A lot of them are flat-lying or sedimentary rocks, like around the Cobalt region. Some of these rocks are deformed and folded up in other parts, like south of Sudbury and east of, west of Sudbury, over towards Sault Ste. Marie. And then there's a sharp line of demarcation between rocks that are readily recognizable and rocks that look like they've been squished around like toothpaste. And this line extends from around Killarney and Georgian Bay up through the Tomogamy area, southern Tomogamy area, over to the Ottawa River. And these very highly squished and fluidized-looking rocks we call the Grenville Province. They've all been metamorphosed at a fairly late stage, somewhere around 1.1 to a billion years ago.
Yes, the shield is known in a very general sense to be made up of pink rocks and green rocks and gray rocks, I guess. That is a function of the most typical colors of the most abundant rocks that make up these shield areas. The pink rocks are typically granitic or granitoid units. That's because of the mineral composition of the granitoid rocks, that's the color they weather. The pinkish shade is largely due to the weathering of the feldspars. And the green rocks are more typically metamorphosed volcanic rocks, which typically are at a metamorphic grade that results in the crystallization of green minerals like actinolite, like chlorite, and that gives them their green color. And those belts of rocks are what are famous as greenstone belts.
As opposed to viewing it scientifically, rocks to us represent another life form upon this earth. They are alive. They are very alive. If anyone should experience or even have heard about the ceremonies that we have, rocks are a very important part of our ceremonial world. Rocks have power beyond probably any European person's conception of power. If you look at these mountains, you see more than beauty. Beauty is power, but it is a rock formation that no one to this day can determine when they came to be, how they came to be. There are many theories about it. We accept them as another life form upon this earth. There's some rocks that differ from others. They're individual, like people should be, you know? Some rocks people are meant to find. An example, one of my late grandfathers rolled over when camping out one time because he was disturbed by a little rock. And that rock he took, and he took home with him. And he said within days, that rock was growing unusually larger than other rocks do. So he kept it, and that became, to him, a sacred object.
I love rocks, but of course I love them intellectually and also aesthetically, because of course it's very exciting trying to unravel what the mysteries that they contain. And it's really quite remarkable the structure that geology has built has given us a pretty accurate history of the whole Earth and of its life, which is quite something. It's a very large structure that we have built, the geologists have built. And therefore, one is immensely prejudiced in favor of rocks. And of course, there is no question that there are many different ways of looking at things. And there are different ways of looking at facts, too. And for those who see other aspects in nature, I would say that this is a deeply important thing, and that it's highly to be encouraged, because unless we have an attitude of love towards nature or towards the world, we're doubly doomed, and we're in a situation now where the so-called and quite incorrectly primitive peoples have an evident love of nature, which we appear to be losing as fast as we can. And this means that we're approaching our doom because we've ceased to love nature. And so I would certainly consider that loving rocks or any natural processes is a highly desirable thing and totally understandable, in the sense that that without it you've got nothing. Without it you've just got a mechanical clock that's going wrong.
Virtually every single process that that occurs on the Earth, virtually every one, is either directly or indirectly related to the simple fact that the Earth is trying to get rid of its excess heat. And that heat is generated by radioactive decay of minerals within the Earth. Now, ultimately, that radioactive decay is going to decrease because the daughter products of that radioactivity ultimately are not radioactive. And so ultimately all of the radioactive elements that are produced in that are generating that heat are ultimately going to be so reduced that the heat engine that drives plate tectonics will be exhausted. And so ultimately at some time in the future, billions of years and perhaps in the future, that the plate tectonic motions, the mechanism that drives the Earth, will cease.
I'm not that educated, okay? So, like, geology or anthropology or would know all the other details. But now, they know, they study the plate tectonic and, you know, the switching of the poles and the earthquakes. You know, the tremors, all these things, why are these happening and all that. Okay, these were all predictions of our people a long time ago on what's going to happen. One of the things was, yes, you know, if you fool around with the Earth, you know, she will fight back. She will strike back. But if you take care of the Earth and leave things very natural, that the Earth will last a very long, long time.
In today's episode of the Earth Chronicles, you heard music from Bela Bartok, Igor Stravinsky, Dmitry Shostakovich, Witold Lutoslawski, Hugh LeCain, and Myron Schaefer. Tectonics was written and performed by Sean O'Halloran, Paul Panchasek on percussion. Poetry written and read by Mary Lou Kelly.
And on it goes, thanking all the government agencies and private groups that helped finance the Earth Chronicles. Earth in Motion, one of 32 narrationless documentaries produced by yours truly here at CFMU, 93.3 McMaster Radio, quarter century ago. You can listen to Earth in Motion. Go to greenplanetmonitor.net. I will post it right there. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm Dave Kattenberg, over and out for now. Thank you.
this is C.J.